You are listening to CFRO 102.7 FM Co-op Radio in Vancouver.
Mother Earth is under the weather right now. Mother Earth is under the weather right now.
This is Radio EcoShock, and I'm your host, Alex Smith. Another packed program for you this week. We have two reports on the efforts to contain climate change. In the later half of the show, we'll play the testimony of UK government economist Sir Nicholas Stern, testifying before the US Senate Energy Committee in Washington. This could only happen with the new Democratic-controlled Congress. Stern also answers their questions about emissions control, competition with China, the costs of inaction, and the future of carbon capture and storage. Before that, we'll hear about the new climate and green energy revolution on Canada's west coast. In British Columbia, the government says it will go farther and faster than California to rein in greenhouse gases. Top Vancouver Sun columnist Vaughn Palmer joins us to give us the latest. But first, let's follow our hearts to the far southern Pacific, where a controversial Japanese whaling ship caught fire and now lays foundering without power just 100 nautical miles away from one of the world's largest penguin breeding grounds. The Prime Minister of New Zealand has called on Japan to swallow its pride and accept a tow out of the Ross Sea from their arch-enemy, the Greenpeace anti-whaling protest ship Esperanza. It's drama on the high seas. We'll start with a couple of clips from Australian National Radio and then News Talk ZB in New Zealand. Then, Steve Schallhorn of Greenpeace Australia joins us to talk about a possible end of whaling in the supposed whale sanctuary.
Last week, the crew on board the Nishin Maru battled environmentalists. Today, they were fighting a fire. The blaze began on the factory deck early this morning. Most of the crew were evacuated onto four other ships in the Japanese whaling fleet.
Japanese assure us that they have sufficient supplies and capacity for those ships to bring all of the crew out safely.
The 30 crew members who remain on board have now managed to contain the blaze, but a 27-year-old sailor is missing. A Greenpeace ship, which was heading towards Nishin Maru to hamper whaling operations, is offering to help.
Our ship is going to the area. We will render whatever assistance we can to the crew and to the ship.
It will take more than a day for Greenpeace to reach the ship, and it will be some time before the extent of the damage can be determined, but there are already fears about pollution.
We think there is up to 1,000 tonnes of heavy fuel oil on board the vessel, as well as many other chemicals, of course. It is the factory ship of the Japanese whaling fleet.
The Sea Shepherd Conservation Society, which is sailing both its ships back to Melbourne, is hopeful today's fire will end this year's whaling season.
Well, of course, we're very concerned about the welfare and safety of the crew members on board, but we're also quite relieved that that's put an end to this killing spree that this illegal whaling fleet has been involved in there with down here.
It's the second time there has been a fire on board the Nishin Maru. There was a blaze on the ship in 1998. Fiona Blackwood, ABC News, Hobart.
And now to Newstalk Radio in New Zealand.
Chris Carter is our Conservation Minister. And Minister, thank you for your time. There's no danger of this boat sinking at present?
Well, it is dead in the water at the moment. It's in one of the most extreme environmental areas in the world, as well as one of the most pristine. It's got on board some 500 tonnes of heavy fuel oil, another 810 tonnes of furnace oil, which is very toxic, plus a whole lot of other chemicals it's been using to rend down the whales, plus, of course, a lot of whale oil on board as well. So it's a combustible combination.
Okay. Do we know exactly where it is? It's Southern Ocean. How close is it to the ice, for example?
It's about 100 nautical miles from the Antarctic coast. One of the concerns is that perhaps the largest largest penguin colony at Cape Adare in the whole of Antarctica is just 100 k's away.
This is a whaling sanctuary, isn't it?
Yes, it's the Southern Whale Sanctuary, which has been a sanctuary for almost 30 years, and for almost 20 years Japan has been killing whales in it every year. We are totally opposed to that and have made that position clear, but as your listeners will be aware, the Japanese are perfectly legally entitled to, because regulations have a little loophole in it that you can take whales for scientific purposes. No one ever envisaged you'd be killing 1,000 a year. Ironically enough, Larry, no science has ever come out of the 20 years of killing whales.
Yeah, I'm not sure whether everybody does understand this. I couldn't understand why they can legally whale in a whale sanctuary, whether it's for scientific purposes. Actually, the law, the international law's useless, isn't it? It's impotent.
Well, we would certainly like to change it, but it's a process that the IWC, which Japan has a lot of friends at, of course. They've recruited a lot of little poor countries to come along and help them. But that's another issue. I suppose today we're focusing on saving those sailors and preserving the environment.
Thank you for your time, Minister. That is Chris Carter, the Conservation Minister. Joined by the captain of the Farley Mowat, Paul Watson, joins me. Paul, good evening to you. Thank you for your time.
Oh, thank you.
What has happened today? What have you been doing today? No confrontation with whaling ships?
No, we're chasing the Japanese whaling fleet. They're running away from us. They seem to be afraid of us, so as long as they're running, they're not killing whales.
So they're on the run, are they? What about the condition of your vessels, what the Robert Hunter and the Farley Mowat?
Well, the Farley Mowat wasn't hit, but they did ram the, yesterday, ram the Robert Hunter. They hit it and put a gash in the bow and another hole above the waterline on the stern, but they also shoved us up against the ice, which stove in some plates below the waterline, but fortunately they didn't break, so it could have sunk the vessel. But the interesting thing about it is after they hit the Robert Hunter twice, they then issued a marine distress call, even though they had done the ramming, and then told New Zealand Search and Rescue that they were in grave and imminent danger, at which point I reported I didn't see what kind of danger they were in, and then they left that shortly thereafter. Well, they've got a good PR firm, and we've got an opposition that has unlimited resources, funds, and power. They, you know, they just keep saying lies one after another. I mean, I swear if I hit these guys with marshmallows, they'd be screaming that we injured them. The fact is that they are the criminals. They are involved in a criminal operation. They're no different than elephant poachers or bank robbers, and we're just simply trying to stop their slaughter of an endangered species in a sanctuary. Well, you know, we haven't been winning for 20 years. They killed 18,000 whales down here in the last two decades. This is a job the government should be doing. This is a sanctuary. New Zealand, Australia are signatories to this sanctuary. What is the point of having a sanctuary if you can just go down and kill whales in it? We know that they have the authority to intervene because they come down here and arrest and seize vessels that are poaching toothfish. So how is it that if you catch a fish, you go to jail, but if you kill a whale, we just simply ignore the fact that a crime is being committed? Thank you.
That is Paul Watson, captain of the Farley Mowat.
The Greenpeace ship, the Esperanza, has reached the stricken Japanese whaling vessel, the Nishan Maru, and we now go to Greenpeace in Australia for an interview done on Tuesday, Australian time. This is Steve Shellhorn on the line, the executive director of Greenpeace Australia. He's a longtime campaigner with the international organization and a son of Greenpeace Canada. Steve, can you tell us what's going on with that crippled Japanese whaling ship in the Southern Ocean?
Well, the Nishan Maru right now is drifting in the Southern Ocean, and particularly it's in the Ross Sea, which is almost directly south of New Zealand. There are two other Japanese whaling vessels attached to it. One is a supply vessel, the other is a harpoon boat. The supply vessel is providing power and other services to the Nishan Maru. As far as we understand, there are about 20 crew on board that are still damping down some of the fires and are attempting to do some repair work to the vessel.
Well, New Zealand's Prime Minister has warned Japan about being too proud to accept help. That was just today, even from Greenpeace. And he fears an ecological disaster for the Antarctic coast and especially the penguins. Is it really that serious, and would Greenpeace help a whaling ship?
Greenpeace would definitely do whatever it can to prevent an ecological disaster in the Southern Ocean. And if that means giving a tow to a stricken Japanese vessel, and in particular a stricken Japanese whaling vessel, then yeah, sure, we would certainly do that. That's a better alternative than having the ship founder and sink. It has over 100 tons of fuel oil on board, and if that were to leak into the Antarctic environment, clearly that's a disaster. I think the question is, what level of risk are the Japanese whalers and the Japanese government prepared to take in order to avoid the embarrassment of being towed by a Greenpeace vessel? And I would sincerely hope that that level of risk is quite low. In other words, I think they should accept the offer of a tow while the weather is still quite good down there and begin to tow the vessel out of the area.
Is there a chance that it might sink?
As far as we understand, from what we can observe and what the Japanese whaling industry is saying, no. At the moment, it's not in danger of sinking. There does not appear to be any damage to the hull. It seems that the fire damage was inside the ship itself.
And which of the Greenpeace ships is there, and is it capable of towing a big boat like this factory whaling ship?
The Greenpeace vessel Esperanza is the one that is on the scene in the Southern Ocean. It was built as a Russian ocean-going firefighting tug. It still does have sufficient equipment on board to do a tow of this size. It has the large bollards and cleats on the stern of the Esperanza, and the Esperanza is maneuverable enough to tow a ship the size of the Nishan Maru, which has a gross weight of about 8,000 tons. The Esperanza is about 2,000 tons, which is fairly large for a tugboat.
Well, millions of people around the world will really be relieved the slaughter stopped, at least for now, and maybe 1,000 whales will be saved for another year. Could this be the end of the line for Japanese whaling?
Well, we're hoping that this fire will be the end of the Nishan Maru and the end of the factory whaling fleet for Japan. This is the second fire that this vessel has suffered. It also had a major fire in 1998. Clearly, it seems with two major fires while at sea that this vessel is not safe and it should be retired. And obviously, I think that Greenpeace and many people around the world, including many inside Japan, would prefer that a new vessel not be built.
And Greenpeace International has been saying, we love Japan, but we hate whaling. What is the feeling there in Australia about killing whales in a designated international whale sanctuary?
Public opinion is very high in Australia against whaling, whether it's in the Southern Ocean sanctuary or elsewhere. But I think part of the messaging that Greenpeace has been pushing in Australia and other countries is to sort of scrape beneath the surface and look what's going on inside Japan. We've done some polling inside Japan and found that, amazingly, most Japanese don't even know that their country is whaling in the Southern Ocean in a whaling sanctuary. And when they're told that, they are opposed to it. In other words, 69% of Japanese do not support whaling in the Southern Ocean. So a lot of what Greenpeace is working on these days is to mobilize public opinion inside Japan against the government in order to stop whaling.
Well, I wanted to ask you, too, Paul Watson and the Sea Shepherd Society brought a lot of publicity to this issue this year. How do you feel about his latest voyage?
Well, I think from the Sea Shepherd Society's point of view, their voyage was a success. They did meet up with the Nishan Maru and the whalers, and they were able to do a couple of actions of the type of work that Sea Shepherd set out to do.
And a minister in New Zealand said a tug may be dispatched from that country, but he wouldn't expect a whaling vessel to come to a New Zealand port, considering the government's opposition and the vocal opposition of the public to whaling. How do you see this playing out?
Well, the situation we have in the Southern Ocean is a whaling vessel that is in need of help, and we believe in Greenpeace that the best thing to do is to tow it out of the Southern Ocean as quickly as possible and bring it into a port. The nearest port would be in New Zealand, and I think that New Zealand should allow the Nishan Maru in order to repair damage to the ship. I think that is the safest option.
All right. Well, on a personal note, I know you were an anti-nuclear campaigner for years and have seen American warships way too close up from a Zodiac. Have you been close up and personal with whales as well?
As a matter of fact, no, I haven't. I have never seen a whale. I've spent much time at sea on Greenpeace vessels, seen plenty of dolphins and porpoises, but I never have seen a whale.
but you still love them anyway, would you say?
I still love them anyways, and I'm looking forward to my first sighting.
Well, I asked that personal question because the killing of whales drives a lot of people to despair about us humans. Do you see an end to this madness? What can we do?
I think we are getting close to the end of whaling. Again, what we find in Japan is that very few Japanese these days are eating whale meat. I think the kind of, you know, urban myth in a lot of Western countries is that whale meat is consumed often in Japan, or that it's seen as a delicacy. And that's not quite true. It's certainly not true that many Japanese eat whale meat. Poll after poll has shown that it's only 1%, 3%, depending on how the question is asked, eat whale meat even close to a regular basis. Most people just eat it once a year on a special occasion. The last few years, the price of whale meat has fallen drastically. It's no longer an expensive item. It's about the same as other meat or fish available at a Japanese supermarket, and many supermarkets no longer carry it. It's very much a generational thing. It's an older generation that is continuing to eat whale meat. Again, polling shows that younger Japanese are interested in whales in terms of whale watching or as an inspiring species, similar to other people around the world. So I'm hoping that within the next few years, what little demand there is left for whale meat will disappear almost to zero, and I think the same thing will happen in Norway and Iceland. So I think the days of whaling are numbered.
Is there anything else you'd like to tell us?
Well, I'd like to say hello to all my friends at Co-op Radio. When I did live in Vancouver, I worked on the Radio Peace Program and what was called The Rational. That was, I won't say how long ago that was, but it was a very long time ago.
Well, great. We've been speaking with Steve Schallhorn, the Executive Director of Greenpeace Australia. Thanks so much, Steve.
Thank you.
This is CFRO 102.7 FM, Co-op Radio in Vancouver, the People's Station. You are listening to Radio EcoShock. If you've missed part of the program, you can always download the whole thing from our website at www.ecoshock.org. Go ahead and pass it on to your friends. Some good news this week from British Columbia, the Canadian version of California. Premier Gordon Campbell has converted from a climate skeptic to a new Mr. Green.
Yvonne Palmer, the provincial affairs columnist for the Vancouver Sun, has been the best guide to climate and energy initiatives springing up on Canada's west coast. We're honored to have him on the show today. Welcome, Yvonne.
Hi, how are you?
Well, good. And Yvonne, there have been a flurry of announcements and big promises from Premier Gordon Campbell and the recent throne speech. It's all kind of a greenish blur for the public. Can you tell us what the government is saying about climate change and what they promised to do about it?
Well, it takes up about a third of the throne speech, and I guess what it says collectively is that the government's finally admitted there's a problem and they need a fairly ambitious program to deal with it. The full list, as I said, takes up about a third of a throne speech. It runs about 40, 45 pages.
These seem like pretty big promises to be making, but Finance Minister Carol Taylor told the press there'd be no new money for it, and on CTV News, Premier Campbell said no new legislation, no money, no laws. How will the government do it?
Well, I think there will be legislation, and I think there will be budget and funding programs over the next few years. As I read the problem of climate change in the Western world, this is not something that's going to be solved in 3 months. We're probably going to be dealing with this for the rest of our lives.
Right. Well, it seems like an almost miraculous conversion for Premier Campbell, who closed the Environment Ministry just a few years ago and wasn't a Kyoto fan. What do you think's behind this change?
Well, if you look over Campbell's time in politics, I think you'll find that on occasion he changes his mind about issues and does a complete reversal. I think we saw it on First Nations, on treaties. In opposition, Campbell went to court to try to overturn the Nisga Treaty. In government, he's now one of the national leaders on the need to reconcile with First Nations, on the need to develop a new relationship with them. And First Nations leaders themselves have acknowledged that. So this is not the first time we've seen a conversion.
Do you see this as a budding alliance of West Coast states with the province on climate change?
I think there's some potential, and there's some need as well. If you take the example of the ports on the West Coast, one of the contributors to pollution on the West Coast is diesel-powered ships coming in and out of port, idling in port, sitting in harbors. And if British Columbia were to take the lead on that, all it would probably do is undercut the competitiveness of the Port of Vancouver, which already has problems. If all West Coast ports made a common alliance to deal, to make themselves greener, then you could potentially have an accord that would stretch, cover the entire West Coast of North America. You would not be able to get goods in and out of North America without bringing them through a greener port. If Los Angeles, Tacoma, Seattle, or sorry, Long Beach, Tacoma, Seattle, the port at San Francisco and Oakland, Prince Rupert and Vancouver were included in your alliance, you just simply wouldn't be able to bring goods into the coast without putting them through a port that had adopted a green accord. So that's one of the potentials on the coast. We don't know till the governors and the premier and everybody gets together whether or not there's any appetite for that, but I think all West Coast leaders are facing this challenge to one degree or another. I noticed that my friend Joel Connolly in the Seattle paper today is alerting people in Washington State to the British Columbia government's new green plan, saying in some respects it exceeds what they've done in California, and asking, where's our governor? Where's our state legislature on this? So, you know, there's kind of a leverage going on here between jurisdictions that I think has some potential for cooperation.
We could all push each other along together.
Well, I think there's, you know, a lot of this going on in a lot of places. I mean, most governments in the Western world are, to one degree or another, trying to decide how far they're going to go with this.
Well, it's great the two proposed coal plants will have to be carbon-free. Do you think they'll go ahead now with the demand for carbon capture and storage?
I think it'd be really interesting if we did go that way. I think the, you know, this test, I think it's in Lloydminster, Saskatchewan, where the test plant is to try 100% sequestration of carbon. If we could develop that technology here, it would bode well for coal-fired generation all over the world. I don't know as though British Columbia will ever get heavily into coal-fired generation, even with 100% sequestration of carbon. But it would be nice if Alberta had that technology available, and it would certainly be nice for the whole world if it was available to China. So I think it's encouraging that a place that isn't that heavily dependent on coal-fired generation, we basically don't use it except when we buy power from Alberta overnight, it would be great if we could make some advances on that by encouraging somebody to use it here.
Well, that leads to my next question. I mean, the premier is still promoting oil and gas exploration off British Columbia. Maybe we'd have rigs and tankers off the coast, and the coal exports are up. Your newspaper reports today more than 250% out of Prince Rupert. How can we really go green at home and still pay for it by selling fossil fuels for others to burn?
I don't think you're going to be able to provide any leadership in the world or get anyone to listen to you until you've cleaned up your act at home. I think that's where it has to start. I think British Columbia is in a fortunate position in not relying very heavily on anything other than hydropower. We don't have a lot of heavy industry that's polluting. Our main problems are vehicles, and, you know, we can work on that. So I don't think you're going to be able to get the world's attention on anything until you've worked on it yourself, and you know, that it's like charity, which begins at home. I think being green begins at home, too. I don't think you're going to see offshore oil and gas development in Canada off the West Coast until the national government and the provincial government and the First Nations who claim the resource sort out an agreement. I don't see industry clamoring for it at this stage. I think they're much more interested in the onshore development that's available. So, I mean, you know, the government technically supports offshore oil and gas development, but I don't think we're going to see it in our lifetimes.
Well, all right. The people up are trying to build some wind farms in Haida Gwaii. We're the first, or the last province, really, without a single commercial wind operation. Have you heard more about that?
Well, the first wind farm that was scheduled for British Columbia, which I think was at the north end of Vancouver Island, the company that was interested in doing it put up monitoring stations and concluded the wind wasn't steady enough to justify building a station. So that was our first attempt, failed on that. There are days, of course, you know, when you wonder, could British Columbia's wind be that unstable? But it's encouraging that people are going to go ahead with that. But, you know, I still think we're going to be 90% hydropower for a long time to come. The power project that I think will go ahead at some point, both the government and the New Democrats are showing renewed interest in it, is the Site C hydroelectric dam on the Peace River.
In your column, you forecast a series of announcements about climate change and energy, a campaign to keep public interest. What have you heard about upcoming plans by this government?
Well, we've got the budget tomorrow, and then the next thing will be the energy plan, and that will probably, it's tentatively scheduled for sometime in March. There will be some kind of a process established to decide on our interim greenhouse gas targets for 2012 and 2016. Probably get that set up later this year. The energy plan itself will probably, is expected to provide some detail on how this goal of making the province energy self-sufficient by 2016 will be accomplished, and how we will get to this goal that by 2016 all of our electricity in BC will be net zero in terms of greenhouse gas production.
Is there anything else you think our listeners need to know about our provincial effort on climate change or energy?
Well, I mean, I think the one thing that every politician that I've dealt with on this issue is asking him or herself is how serious is the public about this, and how much sacrifice are individuals willing to take on this. And that's the big unknown. You know, this issue has gone from being almost nowhere in public opinion surveys of major concerns to being the top of mind issue. How long will it stay there? This is not a problem that's going to go away, even if we stop worrying about it. So I guess that's still the unknown in this, is how much sacrifice, how many new taxes, how much change of lifestyle and way of working and way of traveling are people willing to put up with to deal with this problem, because it really is something that governments cannot solve by themselves.
Yes, how serious are we? Well, we've been speaking with Vaughn Palmer of the Vancouver Sun, and Vaughn, I want to thank you personally for covering the legislature and the government so well. Many of us would be left in the dark without your column.
Well, it's good of you to say it. Thanks very much.
Okay, bye for now.
Okay, bye-bye.
We'll be doing more on BC climate plans in future shows. Stay tuned to CFRO 102.7 FM, Co-op Radio in Vancouver. Now it's time to listen to a little earth-shaking testimony about climate change in the American Senate. Sir Nicholas Stern was head of the World Bank and recently released the most influential report on the economic costs of climate change. That was for the British government. Now we'll hear what he told the senators and their concerns about implementing carbon control.
We do know that even with strong action, climate will change quite strongly over the next 30, 40, 50 years. And that means that we're going to have to adapt.
Sir Nicholas Stern, the UK economist, who caught the attention of the business world when he warned of the huge costs of ignoring climate change, testified before the US Senate Energy Committee on February 13, 2007. I'm Alex Smith, reporting for Radio EcoShock. This hearing would never have been held before the Democratic takeover of the Senate and its committees. It is a sea change in the development of American climate policy. Sir Nicholas advises former heresies like a cap on total carbon emissions for the United States, a carbon tax, and even a higher tax on gasoline. Let's go straight to the Senate for the 10-minute testimony of Sir Nicholas Stern, author of the Stern Report. Then we'll pick up on a couple of key questions and answers between Senators and Mr. Stern on contentious problems like the lack of carbon controls in China and India. Here is Nicholas Stern.
Chairman, Senators, it's an honor to be with you today, and thank you for the opportunity to address this committee. Uncontrolled climate change will transform the physical geography and thus the human geography of the world, that is, where we live and how we live our lives. It involves great risks of economic and social disruption, migration and conflict. The recent report of the UN's expert panel of climate scientists, to which you referred, Mr. Chairman, confirms that global average temperatures have already risen 0.7 degrees centigrade from pre-industrial levels. If emissions continue to rise, the panel's central estimate of further warming for the end of this century is 4 degrees centigrade. This would also give a greater than 50% probability of increases over 5 degrees centigrade, those of you who like to speak in Fahrenheit, that's 9 degrees Fahrenheit, in the next century. So more than 50% probability of increases of over 5 degrees Fahrenheit in the next century if we go on under business as usual. Their analysis is exactly in line with the analysis presented in the Stern Review last year. Warming on this scale is associated with widespread and serious impacts on the availability of water, on human health, on food production, and the environment. The impacts in the US are likely to be substantial. For example, an increase in the intensity of hurricanes in the Gulf of Mexico, still greater water stress in California, sea level rise in Florida, and an increased risk of storm surges in New York. We've already seen how long-term shifts in weather patterns interact with other factors to generate movements of people and the conditions for conflict, for example, in Darfur in Sudan. Abrupt regional shocks become more likely as average temperatures rise, including the risk of sudden changes to monsoon rains in densely populated regions of South Asia, or significant reductions in water flow in the River Nile affecting 10 countries in North and East Africa. To reduce these risks to manageable proportions, we'd have to keep the atmospheric concentration of greenhouse gases below around 550 parts per million of CO2 equivalent. Even at this level, there are serious risks. Indeed, there is only a 50% chance that the eventual temperature rise would not exceed 3 degrees centigrade. So how can we reduce the risks? My initial observation is that previous delay in action means that we do not start in a good place. We cannot control the stock of gases already released into the atmosphere, but we can, as a world, control the future flows. A global problem requires a global response, and equity demands that rich countries take the lead. It's they who are responsible for the bulk of the problem, and it's the poor countries that will be hit earliest and hardest. Controlling emissions will not remove all the risks of future climate change, but it can drastically reduce them. And we've shown in the Stern Review that the cost of controlling these flows is much less than the damages that are thereby averted. The case for taking strong action across the world is compelling. And action is urgent. The later we leave it, the greater the risks, and the higher will be the costs of controlling them. So how much will it cost to reduce the risks? We estimated the cost to the global economy of around 1% of GDP, a cost similar to a one-off increase in the price or cost index. One-off. The models give a range of plus or minus 3% as a big range here. We're uncertain about these costs, but higher estimates embody rather pessimistic assumptions about progress in technologies. Of course, a cost of 1% of extra is not trivial, but it's similar to the costs we accommodate all the time, for example, by changes in exchange rates. That will not slow growth. It is failing to act that will eventually damage growth. The message from the economics of climate change is clear. We must act strongly, and we must act now. The damages that this strategy would avoid can be estimated in various ways. Taking account of the more serious risks that are now evident, simple economic models suggest that the damages, averaged over time and over the range of possible outcomes, are at least 5% of global consumption. There are uncertainties, there are technical challenges in the model, but there's no case to believe that the economic impacts will be small. And indeed, on a number of key dimensions, the models we used underestimated the damages. For example, we excluded irreversibilities and a number of relevant risks. So what are the key elements of a strategy? First, we must ensure that we correct the biggest market failure the world has ever seen. People should pay in the prices they face for the costs of their actions, in this case, cost to the climate. Pricing carbon directly through either tax or carbon trading or implicitly through regulation is fundamental to a policy response. Given the global nature of the market failure and the efficiency that comes from using economic instruments, developing a global price for carbon is crucial. In Europe, we've long had strong taxes on fuel. The European Union has established the world's largest emissions trading scheme and is taking steps to ensure that it's long-term, ambitious, and open to trade with others. I hope that as your committee scrutinizes proposals for US policy, including the range of different suggestions for cap and trade, you will bear in mind not only the potential gains in terms of cost reductions of creating schemes that can link to those in the EU, Australia, and elsewhere, but also the value of using carbon finance as one key element in building cooperation on climate change with China and India and other developing countries, as Senator Domenici described. The U.S. has shown how regulation and standards can build markets, for example, in energy-efficient domestic appliances and tackling other environmental problems such as lead in gasoline. Leadership in the world's largest market sets the pace elsewhere. Indeed, the Sudan now uses lead-free gasoline. China and India are taking steps of their own. For example, China is implementing a domestic goal of reducing the energy intensity by 20% in 5 years. And India, too, is focusing on energy efficiency and increasing renewable energy. But they can and will go further and faster with international support. Second element of the strategy, after the pricing element. We must invest in policy to bring forward low-carbon technologies. Spending on public energy research worldwide has halved over the last 20 or 30 years, and public and private investment are highly correlated, of course. As a world, we must double public R&D spending on energy, and we must promote the development of key technologies such as renewable energy and carbon capture and storage. Carbon capture and storage is a strategy that will allow us to continue to make use of abundant reserves of coal, vital for energy security, without causing unacceptable harm to the environment. Urgent steps are required to move towards widespread deployment of this technology as rich and poor countries alike invest in a new generation of coal-fired power generation plant. In transport, new technologies such as plug-in hybrid cars and the use of cellulosic ethanol could go a very long way to reducing emissions without changing our basic mobility. Further, these low-carbon technologies will create opportunities. Markets for low-carbon power generation technologies alone could be worth $500 billion a year by 2050. The third, final element of the strategy is that we have to recognize there are many ways to reduce emissions now that do not need new technology. Energy efficiency and combating deforestation are very inexpensive ways to reduce emissions, but they require decisions and action on policy and changes in behavior. For example, problems in building regulations and tenant landlord contracts can prevent energy efficiency investments being made. In the case of deforestation, solutions should be based on supporting the countries in which the trees stand to develop their own approaches to this complex problem. So given this, why would anyone deny this case for action? I've heard three reasons to do so. They're all, in my view, profoundly mistaken. The first is that the science is incorrect. I need to do no more than refer to the conclusions of the recent UN panel on the science, which you mentioned, Mr. Chairman, which reported so clearly and strongly only 10 days ago. Second reason for denial is that we can adapt as a human race to any rising temperatures. That, in my view, is reckless. It ignores the risk of very high temperature increases. Business-as-usual growth in emissions over the next 100 years would be likely to take us next century to a world that would be 5 or 6 degrees centigrade, more than 9 degrees Fahrenheit, hotter than today. That's a change which is equivalent to the difference between now and the last ice age 10 or 12,000 years ago. It would transform the world, involving massive dislocation and in all probability conflict. A third reason for refusing to act is that such risks and their impacts will happen a long way into the future, and we, as this current generation, have little interest in what happens in the future. I trust that many of you would find this argument ethically untenable. Chairman, Senators, uncontrolled climate change constitutes a risk that as a global community we cannot afford to take. We have an understanding of the scale of action necessary and of the economic policies to deliver this action. Now is the time to act, urgently, strongly, and internationally. Strong leadership from the United States of America is of the utmost importance. The decisions made by this committee will be fundamental in creating that leadership. Thank you very much.
That was British economist Sir Nicholas Stern testifying before the Senate Energy Committee on February 13, 2007. Stern also warned that adaptation is becoming as important as cutting emissions.
Thank you. I would share with the others on this panel, and it's emphasized very strongly in the report, the importance of adaptation. I mean, what you're seeing and what we're all seeing is the effects of a temperature increase of 0.7 degrees centigrade relative to pre-industrial times. I think it's clear that however strong we are, and we hope we're very strong, on reducing emissions, we'll probably see something like 2 to 3 degrees centigrade altogether. So we've got another probably 2 degrees centigrade or close to 2 degrees centigrade coming, and we're only seeing at the moment the consequences of 0.7 degrees centigrade. So a lot of climate change will be there, and even if we act very strongly. So I think the adaptation story is fundamental, and information, of course, is fundamental to people being able to adapt intelligently. So I would certainly share that.
Now let's look at China. The American senators brought up the common excuse for inaction in their country. Why should they regulate carbon or capture it using expensive new systems when the Chinese do nothing to control their vast coal-burning emissions? First of all, Sir Nicholas says the Chinese are aware of the problem and are taking some small steps to protect the environment.
China is no longer deforesting, it is now reforesting. China has, as I mentioned in my testimony, a 20% reduction in the energy intensity target within 5 years. Their 11th five-year plan started last year, and they are implementing and working on that in a very strong way, for example, through direct targets for the 1,000 biggest firms in China, recently extended considerably to lower tier firms. You cannot sell an American car in China because it doesn't meet the emission standards, which are pretty high. Beijing has an $8,000 tax on SUVs. China in late November, early December, instituted an export tax on energy-intensive goods, aluminium, steel, and cement. So China is grappling with this problem.
Then a senator brings up the problem of jobs going to Asia because multinational corporations will find the carbon control costs cheaper there, where regulations are not enforced. Sir Nicholas answers that concern.
When we take a look at the jobs from the U.S. or England migrating to China or India in search of cheap labor, those jobs are also in search of not just cheap labor, but also less regulation, lower costs. One of the aspects of that has nothing to do with the laws on the books of China or the laws on the books of other countries. Many countries have really strong laws dealing with the environment or minimum wages, but they're never enforced in a number of circumstances that I have pointed out previously. So my question is this: isn't there a natural tension with respect to the agents of production in a global economy searching for the lowest labor cost and the lowest production cost, therefore less environmental regulation, to search around the world where they have those opportunities, and the opportunity even in those countries, less developed countries, to oppose the kind of regulatory structure we've already imposed upon ourselves? We see it every day, see it all the time, see it in China and in India. What makes you, if that's the case, if there is this natural tension, and I believe there is, what makes you so optimistic with respect to both China and India?
What I said about China and India, I should say I emphasize it a bit more strongly for China than for India. I think China's moving a bit faster than India. It was about direction of movement. I think that those two countries, are changing very rapidly in their attitude to energy efficiency and the environment. They both realize that global warming really matters to them. Just, for example, from the point of view of the receding snow and glaciers in the Himalayas, that would increase water stress in much of the year for both countries, both India and China, which rely to a very large extent on water that originates in the Himalayas. And, of course, the glaciers and the snows act as sponges, and they spread it out over the year. Without that, you'll have torrents and floods in the rainy season and dry rivers in the dry season. So they really do understand increasingly strongly how much it matters to them. And they also realize their increasing weight in the world economy and their responsibilities as key players in the world economy. But it's movement in the right direction. I'm optimistic about movement in the right direction, not necessarily about whether it will be fast enough and on a big enough scale to deal with this problem. And that's why I think that collaboration and participation, as Senator Domenici was describing, is so important. But in order to do that, to collaborate effectively with other people, I think you do have to recognize what they are trying to do. Just as I explained a little earlier, when we're in China, we go to great lengths to emphasize just what the United States is doing, because in China you'll be tolls that the United States is doing nothing about this and we're not going to move much more strongly unless the United States does. And we tried to show that that argument is not well-founded, that actually there's intense discussion and a lot of action in the United States on those issues. For example, the kind of plant that you described in your own state. As well as, of course, what's going, the ambitions of California, the trading in the northeast states, many cities in the United States, and so on. So we do emphasize that very strongly, and it's vital to build the collaboration, to have that mutual understanding. On the migration of jobs, we try to take that issue on directly in Chapter 11 of the report and review the evidence that there is on the mobility in response to environmental regulations, and to think that through in relation to the increased costs. It could be an effect. The question is, how big is that effect likely to be? And we have to get quantitative about that. If we're right that the extra cost to production costs to getting serious about climate change is of the order of 1% of GDP, that's like a 1% one-off increase in costs. That's significant. But in very few cases, I think, would it be of a kind that would trigger a big movement. That is small in relation to difference in wage rates of 5, 10, 15, a factor of 5, 10, or 15. So I think if you look at it carefully and empirically and look at the numbers and see how things move, that particular aspect of the story, the extra costs from trying to do things differently in terms of energy, would be a very small part of that story. And by itself, I think, unlikely to trigger a massive movement. It could be different in a few industries, and in those few industries, I think it's important to try to look for international agreement, steel, aluminium, cement. And we discussed those kinds of agreements in Japan and in China, and I think in those few industries which are very energy intensive, it would be possible to build sectoral agreements, but that would involve governments and private sector working together.
Well, Mr. Stern, thank you, and I certainly hope you're right. I understand what you're saying now. This is about direction rather than progress. If you feel that the Chinese have moved it, or at least started to think in terms of moving in a constructive direction, that's different than quantum progress. So I understand what you're now saying. I would only observe, and I don't mean to be either an optimist or a pessimist about this, that the agents of productions, particularly those that have become much, much larger than they were decades ago, have always resisted additional regulations. And when they move to find the lowest cost unit of production capability in China or India or the Philippines, they will similarly resist regulation just as they did here for many decades. Most of what we've achieved through regulation has been over the objection of some very substantial interests in this country. I was just, this doesn't relate to the environmental issue, but it relates to the same thing I'm talking about. The president of the Philippines some while ago said, I think we should need to increase the minimum wage in the Philippines. One of our corporations that's in the Philippines the very next day said, you do that, we leave. The same approach with respect to trying to retain low-cost production in these areas. And I asked the question about, is there tension with respect to the global economy and the agents of production searching for the lowest cost and the need for not only regulatory capability but enforcement that would produce real progress rather than just a positive direction in some of these countries?
An American senator points out there has been some progress using carbon capture and storage in his state. Here are several short clips about carbon capture and storage technology as a way to make sustainable fossil fuels.
There's one technology which we did emphasize and which you have emphasized, I believe rightly so, yeah. And that's carbon capture and storage for coal. And the reason for that is because it's so widely used, around 50% of electricity consumption around the world. It will be over 70% in India and China for the foreseeable future. Why? Because they've got lots of coal, it's under their ground, they don't have to import it, and it can be done quickly. You can get those power stations up quickly, and they're in a hurry because their economies are growing and lots of their people and industries don't have electricity supplies. So it's pretty obvious that they're going to be using coal over for electricity power generation for quite a long period of time. So too Poland and Germany and the United States. It's not just India and China, but particularly India and China. There's an issue there on coal. What's the answer to that? In the short term, to use coal much more efficiently than they do. move to supercritical, ultra supercritical burners. And that's the kind of technology which the rich countries can help with, just in terms of ordinary private investment activities. But we have to have an open view and encourage the transfer of those kinds of technologies. But as soon as we can, we have to move to the carbon capture and storage for coal. And we have to learn how to do that well. And I've lived and worked in India for more than 30 years now in various phases. I've lived and worked in China for nearly 20 years. And I've seen those two countries change quite remarkably in the last year or so in their attitudes to energy efficiency and their attitudes to the environment. There is some way to go, but I believe that there is a partnership there of the kind you described that can be forged. And friends say to us, look, you're emphasizing carbon capture and storage for coal. Sounds like a good idea. It will be more expensive, so we'll need some help with the carbon finance. It will require changes in technology and development and deployment of these technologies. We'd like some help with that too. In particular, show it works in your own countries. So I think if Europeans argue that carbon capture and storage is a good thing for India and China, they ought to show it works in Europe. I think it's a fair challenge from our friends in India and China. But I believe that we can rise to that challenge, and that is a particular area where I think the United States, with its ingenuity and creativity in technologies right across the board, could not only have a big role in creating these technologies, but also in showing how they can be deployed, and indeed gaining business from so doing.
Well, thank you very much, Senator Dorgan. Mr. Chairman, thank you very much. Let me say I agree with Senator Domenici with respect to the use of coal, and Mr. Jacoby, we are going to use coal. The question isn't whether, the question is how do we use coal? And I think these projects are very important to find ways for the development of zero-emission coal-fired generating plants, for example. We have, in my state of North Dakota, the only plant in America that produces synthetic gas from lignite coal. About three decades ago, we were going to produce a lot of those, or build a lot of those plants. Only one was completed. We now produce synthetic natural gas from lignite coal. We have the largest application of sequestration of CO2 at that plant. We take the CO2 from this plant that turns lignite coal into synthetic natural gas. We pipe the CO2 to the oil fields in Alberta, Canada, and invest that CO2 back into the marginal oil wells to increase the productivity of oil wells. You sequester the CO2 from the synthetic gas plant. You dramatically increase the marginal capability of these oil, or the capability of these marginal oil wells. I mean, it is exactly the kind of thing we ought to look to do. As we produce all these biofuels, we ought to take a look at location with respect to using and capturing CO2 to further enhance the productivity of oil development.
It's located all over the world. It's cheap. It's not located in places that are security problems. And it's hard to imagine we're not going to burn it over the next century. So carbon capture and storage is one of the essential technologies. If we can't make that work, we're in deep trouble. I would just say that we're near the completion of a study in which I participated at MIT on the future of coal. And that study, which should be out within a month, is going to argue that we should be spending a lot more effort on the development of coal capture and storage technology, doing studies at commercial scale. We are spending a lot of money in the United States. We do have the FutureGen program, but the argument is that's not enough.
Perfection's a tough ask. I think you need a combination of measures. In the report, we argue that regulation and standards can play an important role in giving confidence in the direction of a market. If you require unleaded gasoline and you state that that's going to come in, and it's definitely going to come in, people can plan clearly on that basis. Similarly with catalytic converters or the STAR schemes that you have for electrical appliances, those kinds of regulations, either direct regulation or regulation on transparency and information, can, I think, develop markets. And I think the United States has shown the way in many cases on that. So partly, I think, regulation will have a role to play. Secondly, I think cap-and-trade policies have a powerful role to play. They will have a role to play in different areas, I think, from tax policies. Cap-and-trade in Europe covers about half of Europe's emissions. I mean, it's a big scope of the scheme. It's been going for 2 years, and we've learnt a lot along the way, and what we've learnt is beginning to get embodied in our plans for the next stage. One thing we learned, which may come in the category of the blindingly obvious, but it is that if you give away too many permits, you're going to have a very low price for a permit. That's economics 101, I guess. And that's something which did happen in the early stages and which we've taken the lessons from now. And in the second stage of the scheme, which runs from 2008 to 2012, the plans for the permits around Europe are coming in now, and the Environment Commissioner who has to deal with them is taking a much more robust line than was the case the first time round. So the scheme itself, I think, is a good scheme, but the way it's operated and the kinds of ways in which permits are issued will, of course, make a very big difference. So I think your emphasis on learning as you go, both about how the scheme operates and about how the technologies are coming forward to give you more opportunities, those kinds of ways have to be enshrined and embodied in the schemes. So you have to be strong on the ambition, so you have to have scarcity, otherwise markets don't work. You also have to, in this case, look long. Our third phase in Europe will be 2012 to 2020. The current periods of up to 2012 are far too short for people to make investment decisions in these kinds of industries. So going long is an important part of the design of a scheme, and being open to other trading schemes, being open to the possibilities of linking up with northeastern states, with California, with Australia as it comes through, with India and China as they start to develop. Openness, I think, will be an important part of, of that story. So within cap and trade, I'd emphasize scarcity, long time horizons, and openness, but the ability to adjust along the way as information comes in. In Europe, taxation on gasoline is a very important part of the policy, and I think that has a role to play as well. So I would look across regulation, cap and trade, and taxation, and we've already, with Senator Domenici, made strong emphasis on research and development and deployment, so I wouldn't cover that again. So I think that cap and trade's going to be crucial, but as part of a suite of measures, a suite of policies that looks across the board in the way I just tried to describe.
You have been listening to a summary of the testimony of Sir Nicholas Stern at the Senate Energy Committee on February 13, 2007, and this was prepared by Alex Smith of Radio EcoShock at www.ecoshock.org. If you want the web address to view the whole two-hour video of Sir Nicholas Stern at the Senate Committee, go to our blog at www.ecoshock.org/podcast. You are listening to CFRO 102.7 FM, Co-op Radio in Vancouver. That's it for Radio EcoShock this week. Join us every Friday at 1 o'clock. Listen via your community station. Tune in by satellite at Star Choice Channel 845. Get it live on the web Fridays at www.coopradio.org or download it later at www.ecoshock.org. This is Alex Smith. Thanks for tuning in. Mother Earth needs your help. Here's a bit of the global warming blues with Lenny Solomon.
He loves to go shopping in his SUV. A car that large is rocking, yeah, fits him to a T. When he gets behind the wheel, feels that engine whine. He doesn't think of the gasoline and he's burning all of the time. Will it be an hour later when he gets a clue? Global warming is coming, baby, it's gonna get you. Well, I make so much money, I could buy me a continent. I'm gonna build me a trophy house with every compliment. A fridge as big as Venus,
stove as big as Mars, with all the modern conveniences. You see, I'm a star. Will it be now or later when he gets a clue? Global warming is coming, baby. It's gonna get you.